So I sent the agenda out. Are there any updates or changes to the agenda? Anything that we should discuss that's not on the agenda? I have one thing.
I had something in mind, which I don't remember the issue number for. It's fairly recent. It's about whether to repeat data in a frame, or if someone likes to build up an in-memory graph instead. Do you recall
Yeah,
that
I mean,
issue?
isn't that the deep embedding, the multiple embeds issue?
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's right.
Okay. Do you
We can
want
put it at
it? Okay.
the end if we have time. I'm interested in it because, as I just discussed, I'm tinkering a bit with alternatives to the RDF API and possible values in thinking both in the JSON-LD mindset and in the general RDF API mindset for some problems I'm trying to solve.
Okay. Okay.
We'll see.
All
It
right.
might be worth talking a little bit about the grammar. I think in specific, Marcus had some thought there was a couple of the grammar rules that might be controversial, 21 and 22. If that relates to the syntax, then we might probably want to discuss that.
Okay.
All right, so let's see. Do we want to discuss the grammar first? Then, because I can imagine that being a fairly long discussion.
Well, I just thought perhaps if there were some specific issues in there that some specific points in there that we could quickly see if we could get some clarification on or just push
Okay.
back to the list. I think in
Okay.
general, if we're going to be in 1 hour, we got to try to limit the discussion on specific items.
Okay. Okay. The other thing is, first up, the JSON-LD document, the syntax spec. I spent some time over the weekend making sure that I combed through it and made sure all the issues were represented in there that we needed to represent in there, and just basically did some minor cleanup, and then sent a request to the RDF working group that they should start. Basically, they should start looking at it in detail. So we're gonna try and push for a first public working draft through the RDF working group. We've already gotten some comments back from Richard Sagenyak that we should be tracking. I'll try to add those after the call. But just a heads up that the syntax is basically has been pushed to the RDF working group, and hopefully they're going to be reviewing it over the next week or two.
Did Richard have comments beyond the questions that he just mailed out about?
No, nope,
Okay.
no. Sorry, Scribe Nicholas, you're up. Would you mind scribing today?
I'll try. I'm a bit cramped here in the
Okay.
compartment I'm squeezed
Okay.
into, but I think I can manage to keep track of something.
Okay, great, thanks. Okay, so first topic up is the JSON-LD grammar. And I think we have a, let me try and find a link to it.
I've got it if you don't.
Okay, I got it there. Okay, and
That's the
this is
issue.
114.
Yeah.
Okay, and then the link to the spec is there at the top. So I took what I tried to take what Marcus had more or less and put it into the spec, but I kind of reworded it in a way that builds on top of the language we were using in the spec. And so I think one of the open questions with the JSON-LD grammar is how exactly are we going to express it? Greg had mentioned that typically in W3C you use EB and F to express a grammar. I'm slightly concerned that that might not be expressive enough, or rather, if we express it in EBNF, that it's going to be very difficult for people to understand what exactly is going on, if there isn't also a clear set of kind of rules that people can look at to follow. Marcus, I know you said that there are a couple of issues when I did the translation that you found. And Greg, you mentioned that there may be some controversial things in the grammar. So let's go ahead and talk about the controversy. Marcus, actually, could you take us through the places where you think that there were errors? Were they simple errors, or do you think that they were fairly large errors?
There were some minor errors, like for example, if in a net value object, the at type can't be an array of like, it has to be an array of just one element if it's an array, or also a controversial thing.
Okay.
But I didn't go through it in detail, so I just linked the issue in the spec and in the timestamp spec, and I will go through it in the next couple of days.
Okay. So it's stuff that you feel like you can just edit and fix. There doesn't need to be that much discussion about it.
Yeah. I just put the pointer now in that you sent that version out. So
okay.
If there's something, they can look up the issue.
Okay. Greg, you said that there could be a couple of things in there that are controversial.
I haven't looked at it closely enough to say so, but I'm just Marcus' response to my thing about EBNF indicated that 21 and 22 might need some more discussion, and I don't know what other things might be in there, so Marcus is probably best to go through those.
Yeah. Well, for example, at type, that's the discussion we had already some time ago. If we allow an object or another node in there, or if it can just be a string.
There's an agenda item for that one today.
So that's related to that. And the other thing is, what was it? Where are we going to allow a relative IRIs? For example, in the context, can we use relative IRIs there or can't we? I think in the current spec we say just absolute IRIs.
As I understand it, and the way my processor works is I actually pass a value to expand IRI as to whether it is a subject, predicate, object, or data type. Data type, right. And then the value of that type is treated like a data type. So predicates and data types need to be absolute IRIs, but subjects and objects can be relative IRIs. That's the way that mine works, and I think that's, in general, what needs to be done if you're going to be able to use the base URI of the document to expand relative URIs.
Okay.
What was the important? Sorry. Subjects, objects, predicates, and
data types.
Oh, data types.
And at type is treated like a data type in that regard. In other words, when it's used as the establishing a type for an object, that type must be an absolute IRI. It's not processed relative to the document base.
For type.
Yeah. So if you say it's a type person, right, that person should not be resolved relative to the document location. It really must be an absolute URI. It's got to be FOF person or schema person or something. A relative URI is not.
Right, but I guess the question Marcus is asking is what happens if there is a relative IRI in there? Let's say someone puts just capital P person for type, what does that expand out into?
Well, it's ignored. It's just treated like any term which does not resolve to an IRI. So the if you have a property which is a relative IRI,
mm-hmm.
right, it's treated like or a property which is an undefined term or treated equivalently, they're ignored. So that
mm-hmm.
same would be true for if you used a data type of if you just said integer without being XSD integer, that would effectively not say anything, so it would be ignored
mm-hmm.
as well.
I'm wondering if it would be simpler for authors where we would just have the exact same mechanism all over the place for resolving IRIs. So basically, if you are expecting an IRI in something in like a keyword or basically if the value is supposed to be an IRI, then a relative IRI is allowed in that case. I understand. So there's a trade-off here, right? If we do that, then all of a sudden data ends up being generated that they didn't necessarily expect to be generated, whereas with the approach that Greg's talking about, you don't end up generating the data at all. So you don't end up generating faulty data in that case. But I think the complexity trade-off is with the approach that Greg's talking about, the author needs to understand where relative IRIs are allowed and where they're not allowed.
In practice, I don't know how much that's true because we're talking about properties, and we've already said that properties that do not expand to IRIs are dropped on expansion, right?
Value.
No, but it's an IRI, and so that's the question is if that. Why don't we then treat a undefined term as being a relative IRI? And we have previous decisions to say that we're not going to do that. They're going to be ignored. So why then is it different if it's, let's say if there was a slash in there, so you could tell it's really something that's more of a relative IRI than an undefined term. It seems to me if we want to be consistent on that, it's based upon whether it expands to an absolute IRI or not.
I agree with that. I think that in practice, when you understand the very different roles that terms, types, and data types play in relation to normal subjects and objects, it will become apparent. I mean, this is the way every RDF syntax I've ever come across works, and these are fully orthogonal value spaces. And I think that the idea that it's easier to understand if we use the same handling for both might be deceptive because they don't serve the same purpose. So I think that I'm very much with Greg on this.
Mm.
So if there is a term which doesn't expand to anything, we just ignore that statement, or what do we do with it?
It depends if it is a if it's an ID, or if it is if it's a subject definition or a subject.
If it's
reference.
String.
Yeah, if it's a string, which it could be a subject reference, right? Right. So if the range of the property is ID, and it's a string, then it's treated like a term or query or relative IRI.
But didn't you just say the opposite, like a minute
if it's
ago?
An ID. So if I have subject ID is
So this thing here, would that be a relative IRI or not?
No.
But it would be if it was an ID. So if I did this,
that is.
Right. That is. Okay. So that's the concern I have. That to someone that doesn't necessarily understand JSON-LD, I think that's going to be very confusing.
I just don't know whether it is in practice. And if you were to consider this in RDFA or any other RDF serialization, it would also be clear. You know, if you have a property that's a relative IRI, that it does not get expanded relative to the document base. It's just ignored.
Yeah, but I
don't know if it... I think the group of people that are going to be using this serialization are not going to be familiar with RDF at all, so I don't know if that argument necessarily... It doesn't follow for that class of developer.
Well, I think if you just say that properties and types need to expand to absolute IRIs, and it really, I think, is fairly straightforward as to why subjects and objects really are work within the realm of the document, and properties and types don't.
Well, properties don't because we wanted to mix old JSON with JSON-LD. That's the reason there. And we didn't want to require that every relative IRI starts with a slash or something.
Yeah, so another way to say it is everything on the left-hand side, this does not apply to in JSON statements. Everything on the left-hand side it doesn't apply to, but you can use relative IRIs on the right-hand side of a key-value statement.
Except type is the exception from that.
It doesn't need to be. It doesn't need to be an exception. We can just have that rule, and you can have a relative IRI for type. It's frowned upon, but it's allowed.
Yeah, I'm worried that if we get back, eventually, let's say we decide that vocab is something that's important in JSON-LD.
Mm-hmm.
It could happen when we're in a working group. Then you've got a really weird, you have a weird description of what's going on there.
Well, I guess my concern is not what happens while we're in the RDF working group. It's what happens after the spec is a wreck and we decide, oh, we need vocab. At that point, this would be a disaster, right, if we had relative IRIs, because then all the documents in the field could potentially change. They probably wouldn't, though, because you'd have to add vocab to the context.
I think that's an important point, though, because, well, for one, when I generated JSON-LD from RDFA, I really would have preferred to have vocab, but that's just a cursory reason, really. I think that the primary thing is that type and properties are very special and mean something very technical, so I don't think that people will be confused in practice because they serve a very distinct purpose from ID in general.
It would be weird if someone puts really in like something like slash type person, and that would just be ignored, for example.
Well, that's what I believe. If we had tests right now, I believe that is the expected behavior from the current spec, is that would be dropped because it's not an absolute IRI.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, well, why it doesn't seem. It seems to me that we have a rule because of kind of, for lack of a better way of saying this, RDF cruft that's built up. Right.
Well, I don't see that as cruft. I think there's really good reasons for that. That these things must have some meaning if you're going to do, and you know, I'm sure once if we try to resolve this here, we get to the working group, then anyone that's got some semantic critical eye on this is going to start to take exception, I think, because you're going to get into inference rules and
well, but
all
then
sorts
we're talking
of stuff
best
like
practice.
That.
I think it's important to make the distinction between best practice, whereas this is clearly not a best practice, and what's allowed by the grammar. Right. I'm just talking about what's allowed by the grammar and what's the easiest to teach a developer. So the less branching and ifs we have when we're explaining, I think the better off we are when it comes to teaching this stuff to people. Now, as far as a best practice, this is absolutely not a best practice, and it's frowned upon. You should not use relative IRIs for type. But that doesn't mean that the grammar should disallow it. I'm concerned that for everything that the grammar disallows, it's one more thing that the developer has to learn.
Well, I think this is also a problem where we get into trying to describe this in terms of a grammar, because I think at a grammar level, you really can't give simple rules to determine if something's going to be an absolute IRI or not. That happens at another level after you've run it. I mean, if you believe that the principal use of a grammar is to basically create a parser to get an abstract syntax tree out of a document, then that's not something you can determine from an abstract syntax tree. That's something that requires that you process it relative to one context. And for that matter, two different documents might be interpreted entirely differently if the context is provided separately.
Right, right. Which is why I'm concerned about the whole EBNF, using EBNF to try and express this, because I don't think what we're doing is expressing a grammar for a parser. I think we're doing something else here.
Well, then we probably don't want to call it a grammar. It's something else, because I believe that's what a grammar is.
Okay. Well, that's fine. I'm fine with calling it something else. I think so. You know, thinking going back to the reason we started this discussion, we wanted or Marcus said that he wanted something that was very specific on what is allowed and what is not allowed. Right. And then we needed to understand how strict mode and non-strict mode. I know we've changed it now. So we need to figure out how a JSON-LD processor is going to report back that there was an issue with the incoming JSON-LD document. And for that to happen, there have to be a series of rules that says this is allowed, this is not allowed, or this is what constitutes a quote-unquote good JSON-LD document, and you have violated one of the rules that constitutes a good JSON-LD document.
And we should be able to determine that from the syntax rather than, I think currently we've done that in the API document in the context of the processing rules where we determine what exceptional conditions are.
Right.
Versus trying to do it in the syntax document.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you can't expect everyone reading the whole algorithm just to understand what's valid and what's not.
Yeah, no, I wasn't making an argument there. I was just saying that's currently the way we've done it.
I mean, this discussion now shows that we don't agree on such fundamental things already. So,
well, no, I think it's just one fundamental thing. I don't think it's. I mean, I could go either way on this. I don't necessarily agree with Nicholas and Greg's position, but I don't think it would be a horrible, terrible thing to go forward with it. I think it's good that we're doing this because it allows us to kind of finally say these are exactly the rules, but again I think this is kind of a, I've never had to do something like this in another spec before, and I'm trying to understand why, because the JSON-LD processor isn't going to actually stop processing if one of these rules are violated. Right, it has a way of recovering from it or figuring out, you know, these are basically suggestions to authors to create a good JSON-LD document. But if these rules are violated, the JSON-LD processor can continue. Whereas normally, if a grammar is violated, the parser just quits. Right. So these are almost authoring best practices that can be enforced by a processor.
That's not entirely true. I think compilers in general are expected to continue processing past syntax errors and to in order to generate the most. And there's quite a field of how you do error recovery in LL1 grammars, for instance. So I think it might actually be useful for us to do something which truly is a grammar, which basically is a more restrictive notation of JSON that is compatible with what we do, and then have a separate consistency rules which work alongside the grammar where you get to those higher level things. For instance, that if I express that a value object, is some combination of value, ID, and type, I could express in the grammar that it's either value, a value and an ID, or a value and a type, but not value, ID, and type. Or I could do that in a sort of at a higher level and say that this is that if you have the combination of these things, that's an exceptional condition.
Right.
And moreover, which one is ignored?
Right.
Yeah. I think that the JSON-LD algorithm spec could be defined so that it defines what it does if given the at type keyword, for instance. It will try to, what it will do if it's a string, and what it will do if it's an object. And if it's a number, it won't do anything, which it leads to it being ignored. We don't have to formally specify a grammar which excludes numbers explicitly. It's just that I don't know what to do here, so I'll ignore this. It's not information that is actionable for the JSON-LD processor.
Well, the spec isn't written that way, at least not the algorithms. They expect that they get past the right thing currently.
I think it's a little dangerous if we rely upon things that we don't say to influence programmers, that we should be more explicit about that to remove ambiguity.
Yeah, I agree. I think we should be very explicit with what's allowed and what's not. I mean, the problem with that
is the permutations. My point is that we should specify what is handled, but that's different from what's allowed. Anything is allowed as long as it's valid JSON, but a lot of things will be dropped and ignored because it's not handled.
So looking at looking at Marcus's list and looking at it in the spec, it's not that complicated, right? And that I'd say we capture maybe 70% of what needs to be captured in what's in the spec right now. I'm sure that needs to be tweaked and we need to think about corner cases, but it's really not that complicated. I'm perfectly fine with there being a grammar beside that as well to just make it very clear about what the intent. The grammar makes it very clear about what the lexical space is, and then the rules are just a kind of a plain human readable list of rules that say this is what is supposed to, this is what constitutes a good JSON-LD document. And then maybe having some of Nicholas's, anything else is ignored. So if you don't see something in here, if it doesn't say that something's strictly allowed, then it is ignored. So at that point, someone looking at the rules can look at their markup, and then they can go down this list, of 16 or 20 or whatever rules, and if they don't see a match for what they've, authored, then it's going to be ignored.
Yeah, and we can omit any kind of warnings and violation information, but I think that we should, when thinking about this, we should approach this in the same way that the Atom specification has approached things, because just like Atom works within XML, JSON-LD works within JSON, so they have shoulds and musts and everything else is ignored. You must have something like a title and a content element, but entries that lack these won't stop any parser from behaving, and even most implementations from being able to use this stuff anyway. And you can throw in forbidden attributes anywhere, because I think that they explicitly specify something along the lines of that they have, for instance, they have an informative RelaxNG definition. It's not normative, and parsers are not supposed to use that and stop anything not looking and conforming like that from being processed as atom.
Yeah, well, it's a bit different, I would say.
Can I suggest we... There's so much discussion, we just push this back onto the list, because we've spent
sure.
half an hour, so we probably should talk about some other stuff.
I just wonder what the difference is in...
For example, in XML, everything is a string. You don't have numbers, booleans in there. You are clear where it is an IRI and where it's not, whereas in JSON, we don't have support for IRIs, so we don't have, for example, pointed brackets. So
well,
you
that's the same case in...
No.
Sorry?
Yeah, in Atom you have rel attributes and href attributes, and then you have content attributes and lang attributes. You have many different kinds of value spaces in different attributes.
Yeah, but the value of all of them is a string, whereas here @type could be false as well. And false is not the string false, but it's a different thing.
Yeah, but I don't think that's different in nature.
Well, but the false of string, you can interpret that as an IRI, whereas the false of the Boolean, you can't. For example, but that's just one example. But yeah, I agree with Greg, we probably should put that back to the mailing list.
So you can, technically in JSON, well, at least in JavaScript, you can use, like if you had type false, and let's say that we, for whatever, let's say you have ID false, you can interpret that as a string, and it'll give you false, the string. So that could be one way that we could get around this, is the value is interpreted as a string, it must be cast to a string, and then... You know, it's treated as a relative IRI, for example, if it's ID.
The danger is that we're also now introducing a lot of bad data into a graph, which, you know, there's two sides of that. One is says, well, you just emit as much as possible, and the other is you try to not create bad data.
Right, yeah, and I'd say we should err on the side of not creating bad data. Which is a supporting argument for do not allow relative IRIs in type. Anyway, I mean, I think we've discussed all of this stuff enough to hopefully come to a set of rapid conclusions on the grammar. Like for example, I think much of what Marcus wrote is perfectly fine, right? We just need to figure out how we're going to state it so that it. Well, of course, makes sense to us and is easy to read for other people trying to learn from the spec.
I think other than the spec writers out there, the EPNS is not going to be very useful in a JSON-LD context.
Yeah.
So it's trying to do it in terms of grammar rules, maybe that's what we call them, grammar rules, is going to be much more useful for the average reader of the syntax document.
Yeah, maybe they should even be called authoring rules, because they're not, you know, they're not hard and fast rules. Meaning that if you break the rule, nothing really terrible happens. You know, the JSON-LD processor will continue even if you break the rule.
Should be made explicit, really, is that JSON-LD is intended to be able to process any legal JSON. Without really going totally haywire, and make the best effort it can to determine the meaning.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay, so let's try and jump to another issue. I'm trying to look down. I think the more specific frame matching issue 110 is going to be difficult to get through today, even though it looks like there's a lot of agreement. There's a lot to discuss there. Issue 118, do we think we can deal with issue 118 fairly quickly?
Well, when I was originally discussing the role of graph in framing, my opinion was that we should, for 1.0, we should really just make everything flat, so as if there is a single, that basically all the triples are flattened basically into a single default graph. Mm-hmm. And that we push off anything more ambitious to another version. And maybe there's a difference between the core framing algorithm and the flattening algorithm, where Marcus does have some what seem to be reasonable rules for dealing with that.
Okay.
But I'm not averse to trying to move forward on these things, but I think we're sort of out in the area of invention, mm-hmm. and we really probably need is some implementations that do this that we can then determine what the issues might be for before we try to standardize the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm working on an implementation. I just have very little time at the moment, but
yeah,
hope to finish it this end of this week, maybe.
Good. So I guess I think this in general, this is kind of the feeling I've had with the this is the feeling I've had with the APIs. I think we might want to step back from it for a while and allow implementations and people using it to happen. For example, I think at our company we need to redo the way we're doing digital signatures on graphs, because we now have a graph keyword and we should be able to actually sign the graph properly now. But without going through that implementation and making sure it works with everything that we have, I know Dave Longley is a bit wary about some of these framing changes, because it could really destabilize the work we're doing, or make some things impossible. The other concern I have, I know this is very high level, the other concern that I have is that if we treat everything as flat, Greg, I want to make sure that we don't paint ourselves into a corner, so that we didn't think about some way of framing or the graph layout, how graphs are supposed to be laid out in the objects, and we prevent ourselves from implementing something really useful in the future.
Yeah, I think it probably centers around the use of the graph keyword in a frame.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And at the time for the time being, that would just be unspecified.
Yeah.
So but, we might come out with there, because I think we have a fair agreement about how that might work. But mm-hmm. then that starts opening up all sorts of other issues in frame matching. Do we allow the use of an ID to match only things with a specific ID, or
mm-hmm.
Do we extend that to values and things like that? Because it's once you do that, then why shouldn't you be able to do that everywhere? And I think it mm-hmm. would be very useful to do that. It seems like a big rat hole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As this graph stuff can be. So I guess the proposal for right now is just back burner a decision on how graph is specified in framing until there's some form of consensus, or at least there are three implementations of how it should be done, and then we can kind of narrow that down to what we think it should be in framing.
Yeah, I do think, to be fair, it's not simply an issue of graph and framing as being is opening up a can of worms. It's all sorts of other value matching in there, and that framing itself could be a completely different working group and spec, because it relates so much to Sparkle concepts, for instance, and that we probably need to restrict ourselves to what is really required for specific applications that depend upon it right now. You know, PasteWorm being the only real example that I'm aware of right now, and that we look to do that. Perhaps there was a separate framing spec that takes this over, and it sort of obsoletes a more limited frame specification.
I guess the concern I have with framing is that if we make it as complex as Sparkle is, it's going to be very difficult for people to use it, right? You would almost want us to focus on creating a very, very limited query language, one that's really easy for developers to use, that kind of aligns with the best practices of marking up JSON data. I agree with you, Greg, in that, you know, if we find out that we need these extra features, then we can put them in at a later date. But for right now, I'd like to focus on really simple REST web services and basically not supporting anything complicated. If people want to do more complicated framing, they can implement it themselves on top of the API. And then, you know, and then we'll actually have some data that we can go from on how the graph keyword should work.
So you're saying, is that like, are you arguing against adding that value matching, for example?
I'm for right now, and this doesn't mean that it wouldn't go in there before REST, but for right now, I don't know if we really should be adding these extra features in framing, specifically graph. Like, I don't understand the use case for it, but that's because I haven't really looked at it. But I know that with the PasteWorm stuff, we just haven't had a use for this, and PasteWorm's a fairly complicated system. So I'm wondering who has the use case where this is absolutely required that we put it in the spec.
Well, I think graph is rather simple. The other things are more complex and need more discussions than the graph support, because graph is, well, there isn't that much. I mean,
right. While there isn't that much, I'm wondering who has the use case where they need graph in framing. Like, what problem cannot be solved unless graph is in framing? And is that something that absolutely cannot be worked around? Is that an absolute requirement on the spec? I understand that it's a nice to have, but I think we should, especially with framing, restrict ourselves, like Greg said, against putting things that are nice to haves in the framing spec. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I don't know.
From a very distant point of view here, I just wonder if these advanced scenarios really go beyond what JSON-LD is for. I mean, if you have the complex needs and lots of data and graphs, etc., aren't we just re-implementing the entire RDF stack, which already is in place with Sparkle and querying and inference and multiple graphs, and everything's just there?
Yep.
If you really introduce name graphs, so why shouldn't you be able to use them then?
I agree with that argument, Marcus. I don't know if people are going to have multiple name graphs like that in a single document, or rather, if they do, if JSON-LD is the best way of querying those multiple name graphs. So the reason, for example, that PasteWorm has multiple, or the reason PasteWorm would like named graphs, is we want to be able to digitally sign the graph itself. So at most, we're only ever going to have one graph in a document, but it's going to be named. The question here, I think, that you're raising is, well, if you're going to frame something, why can't you call the graph out by name? And I guess with Paceworm, we don't have that requirement. We don't need that. Right, because we're only ever going to name one graph at a time in a document, and if someone, you know, and if people want to have want to be able to query across multiple different name graphs, their application can put that functionality in there. So, for example, our application does query across a whole bunch of different name graphs, but we don't need that functionality in JSON-LD because that functionality. We basically get that functionality from the database backend that we're using, right? So the name of the graph is, or the name of the document graph is stored in MySQL tables or MongoDB tables, and we use that as a part of the query.
It's not graph that it's complex. That's almost already there, everything. It's the value matching which introduces more work.
Yeah, sure. But I guess my point is that it doesn't matter. The complexity is not what I'm concerned about. It's adding new features in that we don't need, that we don't have a proven need for. So I agree with you that the other things are more complex, and we don't want to add, you know, stuff that's that complex in there. But the other point that I'm making is, even for things that are not complex, like graph, we may not want to add them into the spec right now because they're just it's just more rules that developers are going to need to remember, and we don't have a very clear use case for it right now.
Yeah, I'd say like Marcus said, it's really value matching, which is the complexity, and graph depends upon value matching. Therefore, both things would not be addressed at this point. And the embed the issue of the embed thing is much more pressing, and there are reasonable use cases for that.
Right. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Certainly.
So, do we defer?
I think I would prefer to defer this until we have 3 or 4 more months of implementation experience, and maybe a use case will pop up that where we find that we really need it. Okay. Well, so issue 118 then is deferred. Do we, Marcus? I don't know if there was agreement from you or not.
Well, I'm almost done with the implementation, so I will for sure finish that, and
okay.
Then I will see how complex that is, and then we'll see. But I don't want to vote -1 now and doing that without even trying it, you know?
Right. No, I agree. Yeah, I think the general approach here is that, you know, anyone can implement other things on top of frame, like framing, right? So you can, if you want to do graph matching, implementations are more than free to do that. And that could be one of the things that differentiates a lot of these implementations, is that they have these interesting ways of you know, doing value matching or graph matching or, you know, any combination thereof. It's just we once that's done, and if people really like it, we need to make sure to standardize it as quickly as possible so that people don't, you know, diverge and create framing implementations that are not compatible with one another.
It's probably worth having a class of test, which is is a proposed or a
experimental,
exactly.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. Okay, that's resolved. That's issue 118. I think we can, let's just start talking about issue 119. I think that's the other thing. I mentioned that this is an hour-only call. I think we should back off for a bit, just because we are getting to kind of API issues, and none of this stuff is really that pressing, or at least we don't see it as that pressing. I don't know if you guys agree. Does anyone on the call feel like we need to continue having 2-hour telecons to resolve the API, JSON-LD API stuff?
No, not really at the moment. Maybe we should catch up with the implementations and then we'll see.
Yeah, I agree. I think that we need some thinking time on the JSON LD API, the specifically implementations, and then reflecting on what the implementations, you know, how complex they are and whether or not we can simplify them and various things like that. Things that you can't necessarily do on a telecon. You just need time away to think about it. Okay. Issue 119 is this embed behavior. So Josh Mandel thinks that we may want to do multiple embeds, or we may want to basically change the way the framing algorithm works to make the results easier to work with so that you can loop over items more easily and you don't have to create a memory, in-memory graph to be able to understand, basically for your application to be able to work with the data. So he has an example there at the top where he says, this is how we would like framing to work. And it's basically a for each loop, right? And he goes, he basically loops over a bunch of data. But with the current framing behavior, it makes it a bit more difficult to do, meaning that the code's a bit more difficult to write because the for each statements don't necessarily fall out easily. That he has. Specifically, you end up having to implement this find subjects method, which is just it's clunky. We don't want that. So he's suggesting that we do something that's called aggressive re-embedding. If I understand this correctly, Greg, please correct me if I'm wrong here, but it would basically mean that you insert every single instance. So if you have a subject that's referenced in five different locations, you would inject that subject in five different locations after the framing has been completed. Of course, making sure that cycles are broken and things of that nature. So, I guess is there a general agreement that we should be doing this, or?
Yeah, I think what was confusing is the fact that you use the embed and that nothing is embedded. I think the open issue is whether you basically do a single level of embed or you do a deep embed. And I'm not sure that there's consensus on that. And I certainly don't have a real opinion on that, except that it makes it a lot easier to avoid cycles if you just do a narrow level of embed.
Nicholas, you're on the queue.
Yeah. First, Greg, could you repeat that sentence because I didn't catch it properly, the gist of it?
Well, the idea being, at the point you've determined to embed a subject, which could be done, for instance, in the example I have up there, when you have a DC creator and you say embed is true, and then a dope developer embed is true. I think clearly what we want to have happen is that the subject for the creator and the developer is there. The question is if there are deeper levels of object expression within each of those, do you follow that down, which potentially could lead you back to a cycle to the thing that you are embedding within, or do you leave it flat? So in the case of DC Creator, say, the thing that's referenced is going to be like a faux person, which might have a list of faux projects which have DC creators that refer to themselves. So if we do not descend any deeper than that first level of faux person and everything else remains a reference, then we will not hit a cycle. Even if we reference ourselves, then we will get ourself in there, but we won't get the other things, although we might need some special processing for embed in that case to be sure that it's ignored in that case.
Yeah, I think that I've had this situation in two very different contexts. Well, three actually. I have used a tree representation of a vocabulary, an owl ontology, and try to generate a documentation from that. That's one case where I needed to embed the labels, at least, of properties referenced, well, of classes referenced as domain or range, and any kind of references. So it led to a situation where I realized that either this tree is going to be gigantic, or I have to back away from using a tree representation entirely and use a proper graph instead. This is also the case for generally using linked data programmatically. Unless I'm just trying to render the tree as it is in a very flat and simple way, if I'm trying to use it to describe relations, anytime I need a label for a link or the context for a linked object, like the publisher, perhaps the responsible person at the publisher, any kind of real world situation of using data, I need a graph in memory. I can't use trees anymore. The places where I've found aggressive re-embedding useful, and I've used JSON-LD for this purpose, is when I have used my JSON-LD context applied upon a fairly big chunk of data describing a document and related things, and put that into Elasticsearch, because then I could do extremely advanced kinds of orders and filters and facets upon that data, and I really need sometimes even three or four steps of relations to other objects. I need to sort on date values for things referencing the current object and things like that, because those things, for instance, invalidates the current document and things like that, and I need to filter on those dates to see if they have taken, if they are active at the current time, etc. And so I've seen both of these proposed solutions to the problem, and I think that we should actively explore them both and not pick one over the other, because the one is about using the JSON in indexing scenarios, and that's a fairly narrow use case, but it's a very useful use case. It's what makes it's possible to use complex RDF in simple index solutions like Solr and Elasticsearch and MongoDB, because you have to denormalize the record extremely, sometimes to an extreme, to be able to filter on them. And in the other cases, you will probably have to, when you programmatically use any kind of linked data, you need an in-memory graph of what you've gathered to be able to walk it properly and without having to ad hoc look up reference things, have them dereferenced in place in that graph, creating cycles and so forth.
I'm almost wondering if we need a mechanism that is basically a graph data structure, where you can do searches and things like that. I mean, that's where we get into Sparkle territory, right?
Well, it's pretty simple to take. If I have I'll try to be quick. I'm way too tired today. if I have, say, a compact JSON-LD representation of a vocabulary, actually of a lot of vocabularies, because I need labels from them all, it's pretty straightforward if I have a flat JSON-LD structure, you know, with the graph of objects in a list,
mm-hmm.
and then everything is referenced. There is no embedding at all.
Mm-hmm.
But the properties are compacted so that I have simple keys and not colons in the names. And I have also used language to reduce any kind of need for picking the language in the templating rendering, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
If I digest that graph list and walk every property and put the object in place where there is a reference, that's a very simple loop, and it makes the data infinitely more usable in a template or in any kind of programmatic usage.
Mm-hmm. I agree. It's the more complex graph-based one that I was talking about. So I agree with you, Nicholas. I think we need to explore both of them, and I think we are discussing that, right? We're talking about a flag that's embed that would basically do aggressively embed. It would do aggressive embedding instead of, you know, this just a single embedding.
Yes.
So it could be, you know, embed aggressive and embed single or something like that. Okay. Well, we're over time for today. We'll have a telecon next week. But in the meantime, you guys might want to try and follow the discussion on the RDF working group just to stay on top of things that they might raise. I'm also going to try and add issues that they bring up during the discussion just to make sure that we're tracking them. Because it's not quite clear where we should be tracking those issues.
Mano? There is some email exchange going back and forth between the groups, and I think you're the only one that can actually respond for things to show up there. If this is going to be a useful exchange, this is probably a good time to at least get those of us active in this have the ability to subscribe and send emails so that we can have a reasonable exchange.
Sure. Let me start writing that email right now.
You should have an email from Ivan, because I had that issue already. Because I thought it's public, because it's called public.
Yes. So sort of an oxymoron, yes.
Yeah.
You can follow it, but only if you look at the HTML.
Yeah.
Let's see. Well, I have many emails from Ivan, it looks like, so I'll have to find that one. I'll send that off.
It's probably not Ivan.
Yeah,
it's Gus and or Goose. And,
yeah,
No,
Goose,
I asked
David.
Ivan about that, and he replied that you have to be invited expert to get access. And
no,
money, you get a copy of that.
Yeah, it's funny because there are other people that post in that group that aren't members of the group.
yeah, that is a good official response, but I think you guys need to be able to post to that list. I will follow it up with Yvonne and try to make sure that that works. Okay, anything else before we go? Okay, thanks for the call, guys. See you next week.
Right.
Yeah, thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.